Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, a local watershed protection nonprofit, and I am your host for today's show. Joining me here in the studio are three Silver City residents, Adrian Booth, Laura Romnerace, and Mike Fugali, who just returned from North Dakota, where thousands of Native Americans and their allies are working to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. I interviewed Laura on October 25th after her first trip to the Red Warrior Camp along the Cannonball River, and since then she has returned to North Dakota for a second time. I want to take a moment just to thank all the locals who took time from their busy lives and at considerable inconvenience and expense to themselves, traveled to North Dakota to stand in solidarity with Native Americans. If you are one of those people and you're listening right now and you weren't invited to today's show, I just want you to understand that it was because of studio space limitations and not ingratitude. So welcome, Adrian, Laura, and Mike.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you, Donna.
I just want to start with a bit of background in case there's anyone out there who hasn't been following the news. I know people have sort of been taking media fasts recently because there's been a lot of very discouraging news. So let's just start with a tiny bit of background. What is the purpose of the pipeline?
The purpose of the pipeline is to move fracked Dakota Bakken shale crude oil from North Dakota through approximately, what is it, 1,170 miles,
yeah,
to Illinois, where it will then be moved via other routes out of the country to be used by global oil consumers.
Okay. Oh, well, it's my understanding that the original Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, we could just abbreviate it DAPL, that the route originally went very close to the city of Bismarck, North Dakota, which is largely white. And I wanted to know what you can tell us about the original pipeline route and why it was rerouted.
Well, the reason the original route was rerouted is because the people in Bismarck and the surrounding areas said, we don't want the pipeline here because we're worried about our water supply. So then the new route was set to go right next to the Standing Rock Reservation, a mile away from the reservation line.
Yeah, actually, the pipeline was originally routed just north of the city of Bismarck, and it would have crossed the Missouri River north of Bismarck. And that's why people in Bismarck didn't want the pipeline coming through there. It was rerouted through historic treaty lands and lands that are sacred to the Sioux people. And it seemed to be the path of least resistance to the big corporations that are putting the pipeline through.
Yeah, why were they wrong about that?
Yeah.
So the water protectors, as they call themselves, not protesters but protectors, and the land and water scored a real victory on December 4th. So we are recording this on December 6th. But on the 4th, the Army Corps of Engineers denied an easement to drill under the Missouri River and Lake Oahe. And I just wanted to ask, what action would this permit have allowed, and how harmful would it have been to the people and the environment?
Well, the short route under Lake Oahe in the Missouri River is just about the last little segment left in the North Dakota section of the pipeline. I think the pipeline is about 80% complete and about 99% complete or so in North Dakota. And so this was the last little bit that they had to do. What was the rest of your question, Donna?
I wanted to know what effects the pipeline would have on the environment and on the people there.
Well, in the last 6 years, since 2010, there's been, 200 leaks from pipelines built by these same people. And so the concern, of course, was that there would be a breach in the pipeline, in that Lake Oahe and the Missouri River would be contaminated with fracked crude oil, destroying the ability of the Standing Rock Sioux in particular to get their drinking water, which they're forced to do now from Lake Oahe. And, of course, there's another 17 million or so people downstream from there that rely on the Missouri River for their water supplies.
And right. If you drive through that part of North Dakota and South Dakota, just below the state line, you're very conscious of water all around you. You think of this as, you know, high rolling plains, but you're conscious of places between the hills where water naturally pools. There are all kinds of wetlands. In addition to impacting the people, it would impact wildlife in the wetlands and obviously impact people's drinking water. It would impact local agriculture. There are a number of Sioux people who have ranches and farms. It would affect their livelihood in so many ways.
Right. And like you said, Mike, there's already been 200 leaks. And I like to say, the first law of plumbing is that everything leaks. It's right. not a question yep. of if, it's a question of when.
That's right.
So could somebody just explain what happened with what the Army Corps of Engineers did, what their ruling did when it came out on December 4th?
Well, that ruling basically said that DAPL could not go under the river, which is this, you know, you're talking about a matter of yards to complete that section of the pipeline. It said, we are not going to give you the permit. Previously, they had held off on making that decision. The DAPL people we have heard have said that they will complete the pipeline, including through that area, that they will not reroute. We don't know what that means. We don't know if that means they're immediately going to start drilling under the river despite this ruling or what.
Okay. So I remember a few years ago that I had a meeting with the Las Cruces Army Corps of Engineer people, and I was talking to them actually about a quite different event, which was bulldozing in the Gila River after the big fires, and they were expecting a lot of post-fire floods. And so their response, of course, was to bulldoze in the river. And so I was informed by these people, not once but twice, and this is a verbatim quote, that the Army Corps of Engineers is a permitting agency. They are not a non-permitting agency. So, I mean, double negatives aside, I mean, if it's true that they do approve most permits, what is the significance of their denying this permit?
Well, it means there must be an awful lot of pressure to halt the pipeline, and who knows where exactly that comes from. I think it's really important for us all to remember that whatever news reports we're seeing, you know, that doesn't really include the conversations that are happening behind the scenes between all the major players, the federal government, the oil people, and Standing Rock Sioux Reservation.
Can anybody tell me if there was ever an environmental impact statement that was done for the area that the pipeline proposed to go through?
I think
that's one of the
issues.
Right. I can answer that. Yeah. No, they did not do the environmental impact statement, and the reason is because they used something called a permit number 12 to okay the pipeline. This permit is only supposed to be used for very small sections of pipe, you know, like in town, within a town, for instance. And so it was complete misuse of that permitting process. That permit only requires an environmental assessment. It does not require a full environmental impact statement. And so basically what the Army Corps of Engineers has said is that they, you know, needed to see that, the whole
right.
EIS.
Right.
So I think that is one of the legal challenges that are being made, because no doubt DAPL will at least appeal this decision.
Yeah, so the environmental impact statement is just a far more comprehensive environmental assessment of what needs to happen. And it also, you know, under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, as people call it a lot, that means that you have to involve the public. So the public really has a lot of input into what happens. And it's a very lengthy process. It could be months or even a couple of years.
It's usually about a two-year process. And I think that this is one of the most important points, is that not only was the permit denied, but the Army Corps has issued a statement that an environmental impact statement needs to be completed. And I think I'm hoping that they did that because they saw the light. I think that the process that they had used would not hold up in court, and I think that they saw that they had made an illegal initial decision in their original granting of an EA a finding of no significance under the EA. So going forward, it'll be, that's a pretty powerful tool now that we have to stop this pipeline, because the EIS is going to have all kinds of reviews in social, environmental, financial, cost-benefit analyses, and so forth. And I think that there's a good chance that under this two-year process, this pipeline could die under the light of all that scrutiny.
Do you think this permit denial will stop the project, or can the denial be appealed or the permit refiled under a more, a more favorable administration?
I think DAPL is already making it very clear that they intend to complete the pipeline no matter what. I think they're hoping that with the Trump presidency, and we can talk more about that, what that means in terms of this pipeline in a little bit, in terms of the economics of the pipeline. But I think DAPL thinks that they will be able to get the Corps of Engineers ruling overturned. However, if the environmental impact assessment process is already in motion, it will be a two-year process. And I think this current ruling sets up a legal atmosphere to make it much harder for DAPL to just push ahead.
Mm-hmm. And especially now that there's so much attention and pressure.
Right.
They were trying to get away with the lesser assessments, but there's been so much. The spotlight is really on this project, so it'll be tough for them to get away with it. Laura?
Yeah, and another variable in this whole process is that on January 1st, according to the contract between the investors and DAPL, the pipeline was supposed to be finished by January 1st, 2017. And so the investors would have the option of just backing out of the project altogether. Now, one of the ways that we can leverage that contract piece is to start putting a lot more pressure on the investors to divest.
Who are some of those investors that we can pressure? Large banks? Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo?
Yeah, and I don't have the list in front of me, but anybody can just Google investors and DAPL, D-A-P-L, and that list will pop up. It's a very long list.
It is a long list.
And there has been, I would like to say, there has been some success in that kind of pressure. The Sami people of Norway had taken a list, an objective list from outside observers about the human rights violations happening at the pipeline itself with the activists, and their bank, and I don't remember the name offhand, but that they are already starting to divest, and they had a 10% interest in it. So there is really, that's an effective strategy, and I think that is a point that we can still have a lot of effect on the trajectory of this project.
So the water protectors have won a big victory with this ruling, but now is not the time to back off the pedal in terms of supporting the water protectors.
We'll talk about that some more when we come back after this short break, so please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and your host for today's program. My guests today are Mike Fugali, Adrian Booth, and Laura Romnerace, and we are talking about a pretty hot issue, the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, and there's been a lot going on with that recently, so we have really good timing to talk about it this week. So I understand that because of this, the Army Corps of Engineers ruling on December 4th that Energy Transfer, the corporation behind the pipeline, now has to do an environmental impact statement. And we've talked about that a little bit, how they've been proceeding up to this point as if there are all these small pipelines that have no cumulative impact. And common sense would tell you that that isn't true. And we've also talked about how Energy Transfer's partners might pull out of the project now that the permit's been denied. And you've said, Laura, that deadline is January 1st, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I just want to turn for a minute to our president-elect. Very difficult for me to say that. But in addition to the investors that, the couple of investors we've named earlier, we know that President-elect Trump has a considerable financial investment in the pipeline and in energy transfer. I've heard numbers anywhere from $500,000 to more than $1 million invested. And he's already stated his support for this project. So I'm wondering, is this kind of a, is this a genuine victory, or is it kind of a hollow victory that could be overturned? Do you have any thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, I think that the necessity now for energy transfer partners to do a full EIS is a real victory. I don't think it's a hollow victory. I don't think that that we can say with any certainty that this decision won't be overturned, but it will be awful hard. It'll be a hard legal thing to accomplish, especially if they try to get out of preparing that full EIS. Interestingly, I guess under new federal administrative rules, the EIS will also have to address global climate change as one of the factors involved with the development of new oil infrastructure. I saw yesterday that Al Gore met with Donald Trump. Did you guys all see that yet?
I heard that.
They have a big climate change meeting. I guess we have Ivanka to thank for that. I guess she doesn't share her father's views about the Chinese hoax. Let's hope that this is a true victory. I don't think we can be sure of that, but it definitely is a step in the right direction.
What about the other pipelines across the country? I mean, there are dozens of pipelines, and I recently saw Winona LaDuke on Democracy Now!, and she was talking about how people are trying to stop a pipeline in, I believe it was northern Minnesota, it might have been Wisconsin, I'm not sure, and do you think that we're going to see confrontations at other pipelines now? There's a big precedent, the one in Washington State. Adrian, you mentioned one in British Columbia.
There's one in northwestern New Mexico that we're going to be dealing with. And, yeah, I think we're going to see a lot more public protests of these sorts of things. And I think this is part of the educational process. What we're seeing at Standing Rock is really just the beginning of public action and people saying, we're not going to stand for this. We need to change our dependence on fossil fuels. We can't continue going this way.
Right. Laura, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, and it's not just pipelines. Near the San Carlos Apache Reservation, just a couple hours from here, is the issue of Oak Flat. They had this land also that had been used by the Apache people since time immemorial for their sacred purposes. That land was traded off to an Australian mining company. Now, a recent development, just a few weeks ago, there is a spring near there. I don't know the exact location. But the local Apache people there have watched this pool fed by this natural spring just disappear into the ground because the water table has been so disrupted by the mining there. And so that's another water issue. It's another, you know, the water is life mm-hmm. thing. So these kinds of harms happen to our water in many, many different ways, many right. different forms.
I wanted to turn now briefly to the militarization of the police in North Dakota. Well, not just North Dakota, but everywhere. But, you know, I've seen a lot of the photos and the videos of these encampments and the actions that have taken place. And frankly, it looks like a war zone there, complete with riot gear and all kinds of weapons and tanks. And on December 2nd, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch released a statement, and I want to quote just a statement from that. Quote, ways to reduce the potential for violence surrounding the Dakota Access Pipeline protests and to begin a dialogue that fosters mutual understanding and public safety, unquote. So Lynch called the people protesters, not protectors, their name for themselves. And her statement also went on to say that, quote, the Department of Justice has offered community policing resources to local law enforcement in North Dakota, unquote. I mean, that's a bit ambiguous, to say the least. So what can you tell us about the militarization of the police department and also about the DAPL security forces? You guys were there. What did you see?
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of police and security force personnel on the site around the clock, very intimidating. And, you know, some horrible actions had taken place before I arrived. It was peaceful while I was there. But, you know, my general impression was that the militarized sense of the opposition was there to try to goad water protectors into violent actions that then could be used to create the kind of imaging that would kill their support. And they did not succumb to that. This was a very, very peaceful, prayerful, ceremonial action there at the camp. And matter of fact, Bill McKibben wrote a nice piece yesterday, and he was describing why he thought that there was a win and why this was so successful. And he said it's because the water protectors and the Standing Rock Sioux leadership and elders in particular had a remarkable sense of unity. They had a remarkable sense of discipline. They had great imaging, and they had great solidarity throughout the country and the world. And going back to your previous question in terms of, you know, the importance of the Standing Rock situation to other environmental issues, I think it's a blueprint. I think that the progressive environmental community and the Native peoples all around the country and the world are finding a new way to stand in the face of this kind of militarization.
One of the things that I've seen online over the past couple of days is a statement by Dave Archambault, who's the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and he really feels that the recent ruling is a big victory, but he also wants to let people know that there are other ways to support the water protectors rather than coming up and camping. He's concerned right now that it really is important to keep the protests nonviolent, because if we respond to the DAPL security forces, which I saw in action, and I saw them in tactical gear defending a site, a staging site outside of Mandan, peaceful water protectors were massing at that site, and there were these... There are about 30 DAPL security guards in full tactical gear who were waiting to oppose them. No one was hurt. Only one person was arrested on that day. But nonetheless, the threat is there, and they're trying to goad us to be aggressive. We can't do that.
And I would like to add to that that David Archambault has issued a statement requesting now that anyone who is not Lakota, that they start leaving the camps. He said that their work has, you know, that they've done what they set out to accomplish, that the legal machinations that have been set into motions now, that's kind of where the action is. At least that's where a part of the action is. And that he wants people to kind of go home and enjoy their winter with their families. And, you know, then we'll see what happens. So I think that that's really important to respect that. We don't know what the conversations are happening behind the scenes between Archambault and the oil companies and the federal government. So if he says it's time for people to leave, I think that it's important to do that.
Yeah, I saw him on Democracy Now!, which, of course, you can listen to right here on Gila Members Community Radio twice a day. And I saw David Archambault speaking yesterday on Democracy Now!, and he was saying that the Standing Rock Sioux have been talking to the Army Corps of Engineers for 2 years. So, I mean, this has been going on a long time. So, like you said, Laura, there are things happening behind the scenes that we're not really privy to. And then it is important to respect their wishes because it's their land. I wanted to talk just a little bit more about the talk some more about the militarization, the mainstream media, to the extent that they've been talking about this issue at all. And they ignored it for months until just fairly recently. They've largely reported Standing Rock as a violent confrontation between protesters and law enforcement. And yet what you three are all saying is that it was very peaceful. And even though people were provoked, they didn't fight back. Yes, Laura, what did you want to say?
And the language, I think, is really important there. When you say there's a violent confrontation between these two groups, it gives the impression that both sides of that group are being equally violent. But
right.
As has been reported, as you're saying, as we all witnessed, the protectors, the water protectors themselves, are not engaging in violence. They are unarmed. But we can be nonviolent. But that doesn't stop the other side from being violent. One of the nights that I was there was November 20th, when 300 people were injured and 26 hospitalized because of an action that took place right at the pipeline. People were sprayed down with water cannons. Concussion grenades were thrown directly at people. One woman lost her arm. Rubber bullets were fired. Another woman lost her eye, and so on. There were many, many forms of violence that were directed at the water protectors.
And it's astounding to look at the video from that particular night and to hear the Morton County Sheriff saying, oh, well, we were spraying those water cannons to put out fires. They weren't doing that. You can look at the video. You can see that the fires were completely in the opposite direction, and they were spraying water cannons at the...
None of the water protectors were on fire. Let's be clear about that. Yeah. They were being sprayed.
Not literally,
frozen
anyway.
Afterwards. But, right. Yeah. It's been one-sided violence.
Right. We'll be right back after this short break to talk more about the Dakota Access Pipeline and some recent developments, so please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and your host for today's program. My guests today are Adrian Booth, Mike Fugali, and Laura Romnerace, and we are talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline. I just want to mention that Adrian needs to leave us before the end of the show, so I want to thank you now, Adrian, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So if she all of a sudden drops off the radar screen, it's because she had to leave. But we will be continuing the show with Laura Romnerace and Mike Fugali even after Adrian needs to leave us. So right before the break, we were talking about one-sided violence at the camps and about the mainstream media and how they've been portraying this action. And I understand that recently hundreds, if not more than 1,000, not sure the number.
At least 2,100.
Oh, okay. That's definitely more than hundreds. Veterans have arrived at the camps recently, and they are sort of policing the police and protecting the protectors. What's the impact on the ground?
Well, talking to one of the people there in the encampment who's been there for about 2.5 months, the population of the camp is always in flux. So there was maybe 6,000 people there, and then the more than 2,000 veterans showed up. So he said it has a huge impact on the camp and the feel. There was a ceremony that I saw on video last night that they did at the casino on the Standing Rock Reservation, where there was a forgiveness ceremony between the Lakota elders, Chief Orville Looking Horse, and I'm forgetting that.
Wesley Clark Jr. and...
There were other Lakota leaders.
Oh, right.
And then also the military people, some of these veterans that had come, and it was this enormous event.
It was a tearjerker.
It was really a tearjerker. And again, you know, there have been so many dimensions of healing that are coming together at Standing Rock between different tribal groups, between Native peoples and non-Native peoples, and now, you know, between the history of the U.S. military in relation to Native American people. That's what this ceremony was about. They were, the military people were asking forgiveness, not on the part of themselves necessarily as individuals, but as representatives of this systemic oppression, this, you know, the militarized systemic oppression of Native peoples throughout hundreds of years. And they asked forgiveness from these Native elders, and they received it.
That sounds pretty powerful. Yeah, I'd like to see that. So I wanted to ask you, Adrian, what is the current status of water protectors who have been jailed or injured? What's going on with that currently?
That's a good question. I have not been keeping up with that as closely as maybe I should have been. I know that there was a big legal team set up at the Ocheti Shekoan encampment, and before anyone signed up to be part of a water protector's action to sign legal documents and, you know, let the legal team know how to contact next of kin. So in terms of people who have been arrested, the legal team does have information about these folks, But Laura, why don't you jump in?
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, the last number that I saw to date is that there's been 550 people arrested, and I believe that most of them, if not all of them, are out on bail, and so they have this enormous legal team that is, again, behind the scenes. This is a part that doesn't get reported about much. They are working all those different cases through the system.
I was going to mention Red Fawn. Is she, yeah. I don't think she's out, is she? I mean, I think that she's still in jail, as I guess you could almost characterize it as a political prisoner.
Political prisoner, for sure.
Charged with attempted murder after she was tackled by about eight DAPL security forces and sheriff personnel on the ground. Somehow they claim that she tried to assault them using deadly force, and she has not been released. And you see Free Red Fawn signs all over camp and all over the internet, and I think that that is one of the important things to keep an eye on.
And one of the things I've heard about are abusive tactics used by the jailers against water protectors who were arrested, people being made to stay in their cells or holding areas without clothing or without adequate clothing, without food.
Kennels.
It's strip search, body cavity searches for misdemeanors.
Spiritual leaders had things taken away from them that had sacred significance. There were a lot of abuses, and that'll all be coming to light.
Right, and they did target a lot of leaders and a lot of medics on the front lines.
I heard that they also targeted the daughter of one of the leaders out there.
Yes.
And she was stopped for speeding and then held, but she wasn't a driver. She was a passenger. That's a little bit unusual to charge a passenger.
They also targeted media to some extent. And,
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Journalists and medics are being targeted or have been targeted. We don't know what's happening now because the situation is changing so fast.
Right. It's changing pretty rapidly. This could be outdated by the time people hear this. So I wanted to ask you guys about the camps, if you know, because you were all there. So I just see these images, but I don't have a very good sense of the camps, how big they are, what they're like. And I know, Adrian, that you mentioned that your sister was there with you and that she had been treating folks who came in search of some kind of a Burning Man type of experience and weren't really prepared for what they encountered.
Yeah, my sister is a nurse in Arizona on the Tohono O'odham Nation, and she went up to Standing Rock as part of a tribal exchange to help out as a medic up there. And while we were up there, nobody was severely injured in any actions. This is before the big water cannon incident. But she saw people coming in, for lack of a better word, I don't want to mischaracterize anybody, but they were kind of peaceful, fun-loving hippies who were just looking for a good experience. They were trying to stand in solidarity with people at Echeti Shekoan, but they didn't really understand what was going on, and they were really looking for more of a Burning Man experience. And those people, good intentioned or not, were taking up valuable resources that could have been used to help the people who were really serious about this fight and about the issues of indigenous solidarity and clean water and indigenous sovereignty. So that was kind of sad to see.
Yeah, kind of inevitable in a group this size, though. What else did you notice at the camps? What were they like?
Well, first of all, when I got there, I think there was 3,000 to 4,000 people, and by the time I left, there were over 10,000 people, bigger than Silver City. So you can imagine the size of the main camp, and then lots of people across the Cannonball River and Rosebud and Sacred Stone and so forth. My experience was I got up every morning before the sun came up, and I would go to the sacred fire, and I spent 2 or 3 hours listening to prayers and speeches, and almost every morning we had a water ceremony where we walked in mass down to the Cannonball River. For me, the camp was very ceremonial and very prayerful, and I was moved to tears many, many times while I was there. And just, it was also one of those places where as you walked around, despite the number of people, almost everybody you passed had a kind word and a nod. You know, there was just a lot of love in camp. It was a very respectful atmosphere, a very helpful atmosphere. Everybody was trying to plug in many different ways.
Yeah. One of the things that really impacted me was just coming into the camp. You see banners and flags all around of all the different Native nations and people throughout the United States, but also internationally, who are supporting the water protectors and who are either there at Ocheti Shikoan or one of the other encampments. It was just amazing to me. Hundreds of banners.
Hundreds of banners and people from just all over the world, every race, every religion, and everybody standing in solidarity.
Yeah, in addition to what Mike and Adrian have said, which everything they've said I resonate with, really had an impact on me too. There were a couple things that I experienced that I'd like to just share. I was staying at the Rosebud Camp this last time, and every morning about 6:30, a man would walk through the camp singing in Lakota. This, I'm assuming it was a wake-up call, you know. It was so gorgeous. It was an amazing way to wake up. Mm. And sometimes there was a woman who joined in. And then there was a particular morning that I started hearing singing down by the river. So the Rosebud Camp is directly across the Cannonball River from the Ocheti Shikoan Camp, which is the largest camp. And I went down and I saw across the river, lined up probably at least, I don't know, 30 or 40 people in one row, big sort of two or three deep or four deep row of people, and then a space between them and another group about the same size facing them. Well, as I watched and listened, I heard one of those groups was Maori people, and they performed the haka, and they were facing a group of Lakota and maybe other Native Americans. And so they performed their haka and then went silent. And then the Lakota were singing and drumming towards them also in response. And they went back and forth like that for a while. And it is an image. And in the sound and image of that will stay with me the rest of my life. It was incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
Just the women in the morning ululating across the river from each other was very moving, I thought. It was great.
Yeah. Sounds like pretty powerful experiences that you all had there. I want to ask, why did you go to Standing Rock? I mean, we need to take a break in just a minute, but maybe one of you can answer, and then after we come back, the other two of you can say why you personally felt moved to go there.
I guess for me, I started seeing reports on Facebook and social media because so little was coming out through mainstream news networks, and I felt angered about what I was seeing, and I felt very much that I wanted to show my solidarity, and I wanted to bear witness to this gathering of peoples and what was happening. And that's why I went up.
Laura, what was your reasoning for going?
Well, I've been interested in Indigenous rights issues and environmental issues for many years. And I saw just a whole bunch of different issues converging, the historical issues relating to Native American people, and just the matter of how we live as human beings in relationship to the earth and how that is impacted in terms of environment and how we are impacted environmentally and so on. So that's one part. I know you guys need to take a break. Maybe I can think of more later.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good place to take a break. So we'll be right back to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline and some recent developments. So please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and your host for today's show. My guests are Laura Romnerace and Mike Fugali. Adrian Booth was with us, but she just needed to leave. And so, Mike, I want to continue our conversation about why you people felt personally moved to go to Standing Rock at great expense and inconvenience. And so what's your answer for that?
Well, let me start by saying that I've thought about that question already, because in the morning time when they woke us up in camp, oftentimes after some of the initial prayers, the speakers would say, thank you for those of you who have traveled here. Some of you don't even know why you were here. Mm. You know, it's as though their prayers had called us there in some way. And to tell you the truth, that's sort of the feeling that I had, is that I was called to go there. And I just had a very powerful urge to, again, witness and stand in solidarity. I think when I reflect on it, you know, more with my rational mind, you know, I've been an environmental scientist for a long time, and I saw the messaging coming out of this particular issue as different. And it struck me as very powerful in terms of the Maniwachoni and water is life and protect the sacred. These indigenous ways of connecting to the land and to the water and to the earth that sometimes I don't think other environmental groups have given enough credit. So I think that's why when I also brought my 13-year-old son Hawk with me, and I was just at a point in my life where I thought I had the opportunity to provide him that experience as well. And I thought that that would be just about the best homeschool thing that I could dream up.
Well, I asked him right before the show started, he was here, if he would like to come on the air, that it wasn't too late, but he said no. But I wonder if you could tell us what you think his experience is without betraying any confidences.
Well, I think it was a chance for him to see history in the making, and I think that one of the most interesting things for him was the morning after Governor Dalrymple, is that his name, issued his proclamation that the camp was going to be closed on December 5th and that people needed to leave. The Standing Rock Sioux had a press conference on top of Media Hill, and Hawk just happened to be up there right when the press conference started, and he kind of got surrounded by a circle of people so that he was right in the front, right in front of the table, kind of locked in there for a 40-minute press conference. And he watched that whole thing and listened to that whole thing, and I think it was very moving for him.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite an education.
Yeah.
More than what you would learn at school, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys about how this pipeline issue is relevant to larger energy issues facing our society. I mean, we've talked before on the show about catastrophic climate change and climate disruption, and is our society's continued pursuit of fossil fuel infrastructure kind of insane?
The short answer is yes, of course.
We want the long answer.
When you look at North Dakota in particular, they already have such an intricate fossil fuel delivery system in place that I think when this EIS is completed, it'll show that the Dakota Access Pipeline is completely redundant. The Bakken oil shale, you know, was booming back in 2013, 2014. Oil prices were much higher. There doesn't even seem to be a need for this pipeline anymore. But the larger issue, of course, is that we need to stop the development of fossil fuel infrastructure and use those resources to transfer to a more sane way of meeting our energy needs globally. I think anybody paying attention to climate issues is realizing that things are accelerating very rapidly, and we have a very short period of time to work together as a unified global community to try to find a way to keep this planet habitable, not only for ourselves, but for the rest of the living world.
Right. You've touched on this a little bit, energy independence. We heard a lot of talk about that during the presidential campaign, energy independence. Well, on the face of it, it sounds great, right? But I heard on the news that Energy Transfer, the pipeline builders, have admitted that they are the, quote, FedEx of energy. So they export oil around the world, and the oil from the Dakota Access Pipeline isn't even intended for domestic use. So, I mean, you have said a little bit, Mike, about renewable energy and what energy, true energy independence would look like. You know, not building these redundant pipelines that it sounds like we're going to be independent and not be relying on foreign oil, but it isn't necessarily the case. So I wanted to switch back to a topic of Native American sovereignty. In the statement that Attorney General Loretta Lynch gave on December 2nd, she acknowledged, and this is a quote, "the complicated and painful history between the federal government and American Indians, unquote. So I'd like to ask, what are your thoughts on the continuing colonization of Native Americans?
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize that this has been an ongoing process. It never stopped. It began with the, you know, in particular with the Lakota, it began with the genocide, the killing off of their people, the killing off of the buffalo, so they didn't have a way to live, incarceration and internment camps, which we call reservations. The land that was originally granted to them in 1825 was then reduced because gold was found in those hills. And every treaty following that, 1851, 1868, those were all broken. They weren't even, it wasn't like the Lakota came up with the idea according to their systems and said, hey, let's make this agreement. Those were formed by our government and then broken. So through these various machinations, their land has been reduced to about 10% of what they originally granted back, you know, back in 1825. And then there, another generation experienced the boarding schools, or a couple generations experienced the boarding schools where the children were taken from their families as young as 4 years old, and with the very clear intent of expunging all of their cultural heritage out of them, their language and any other cultural practices, so that they came home not even knowing how to speak the same language with their parents and grandparents. Then, in the 1950s and 60s, the Lakota, the Standing Rock Lakota people, had established farms along the Missouri River. They had orchards. They were starting to get their feet under them that way in terms of being able to take care of themselves well. And then the Army Corps of Engineers came through with a dam project. And flooded, multiple dam projects, and flooded 200,000 acres, most of which was perfectly good farmland. And so they had to, once again, leave a place that was working for them and try to reestablish themselves. And now we've got the pipeline.
Incredible amounts of forest land on those floodplains were inundated. Very important resource lands for them, particularly in the wintertime. It's hard up on those open plains in the wintertime, so they sought the shelter of Missouri River floodplain habitats that are now taken. I think one of the important things that we didn't really make clear before was that the pipeline is passing through unceded treaty lands. And, you know, many Native American peoples have been compensated monetarily, I think mostly back in the 1980s, for many of the lands taken. But the Sioux have chosen not to. There's $1 billion sitting in an account, a federal account, that has never been taken by the Sioux people because they do not want to give up their sovereign rights to those lands. So when you hear people saying that this pipeline is not going across the reservations or so forth, it truly is an unsettled legal issue between sovereign nations. And so they have a real claim on those lands, not only for the section that crosses the Missouri River, but for much of the pipeline as it passes through that part of North Dakota.
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't heard that before. I mean, I guess I didn't really fully understand what unceded land means. Okay. Interesting. I want to just switch gears very slightly here. We just have a few minutes left in the show. And this is a very complex issue. And, you know, this is the second time we've talked about it on Earth Matters. And I wanted to ask you to, if you have some suggestions for how people could learn more about the issue and how also they could help if they want to. I mean, I know that the nature of getting involved has changed in the last few days, with the Standing Rock Sioux leader asking non-Lakota people not to come to the camps. What can people do these days to show solidarity?
The most important thing right now strategically, and there may be other ideas out there that people can explore, but I think putting pressure on the investors to divest from this project. I think that January 1st deadline, that's an important turning point, or could be, if the the banks and other financial institutions that are bankrolling this just feel like they're going to suffer too much.
Right.
Yeah, if they keep going with it.
Yeah, there's been some protests right here in Silver City in front of Wells Fargo for the last couple of weeks, right, Mike?
That's right. And Wells Fargo sent a letter to the Standing Rock Sioux leadership just a couple days ago asking for a meeting because they were feeling the heat. And so they want to meet and discuss their relationship.
Good.
That's so it's
good.
Working. Yeah. We should keep doing more of that. We should do more of that.
And in, are there any particular news sources that people can go to if they want to find out about this? I mean, I know the mainstream media until very recently has sort of been ignoring this whole thing because, you know, we wouldn't want to show that people have power, right?
I think going to the Indigenous News Network and other Indigenous news agencies is a good place to start.
LakotaLaw.org, I think, also is doing a good job of presenting the legal issues.
Okay. Okay, those are some good suggestions. We only have a couple of minutes left in the show. I wondered if you two had any last thoughts you want to leave our listeners with, put you on the spot a little bit here, anything we haven't covered yet.
Okay. Well, I think I touched on it a little bit earlier. I think it's really important to bring this home. I think that Standing Rock and the events there have really brought to the surface a lot of feelings and a lot of awareness in people about what we're doing wrong, the things that we're doing so badly, and the need for this change. But that change needs to happen everywhere, not just at Standing Rock. We need to put that energy into local issues like the Diversion Project, and maybe I would really love to see more people from Silver City showing solidarity for the Apache, the San Carlos Apache people on the issue of Oak Flat. It's an you could drive there and back in a day. It's really easy to do. So if anybody would like to kind of get connected to that issue, you can contact me on Facebook. I'm easy to find.
Okay, and that's Laura Romneray speaking. Mike, we just have a couple of 20 seconds left or so.
Okay, well, I think you should educate yourself as much as you can on indigenous sovereignty issues, and I think that we need to follow the progress of this environmental impact statement in terms specifically of the Dakota Access Pipeline very closely and carefully, and keep putting pressure on the Trump administration to carry through with that process. And I think we need to keep energy issues more generally in a global perspective, and we just need to keep focused on trying to deal with this climate problem that we're all facing.
Well, Laura and Mike, thank you so much for being on today's show. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. And you can visit the Earth Matters page online at gmcr.org to hear the whole show. Please join us next week.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.